This is an ABC podcast.
Расцветали яблони и груши, поплыли туманы над рекой. Выходила на берег Катюша, на высокий берег, на крутой.
Oh, I'm fired up now. The stirring voices of the Red Army Choir. Yes, comrades, on this episode of This Working Life, we are going back to the USSR to find out what Russians can teach us about something we do in our working lives every day. Sometimes without even knowing it, we negotiate. Hello, I'm Lisa Leong. Kyle Wilson is a former diplomat, Russian expert and visiting fellow at the Centre for European Studies at ANU. Alan Parker is a renowned negotiator whose books include The Negotiator's Toolkit. Kyle and Alan are my guests on this, our latest instalment of This Working Life's book club. Privyet, both of you. How did I go, Kyle?
Excellent. 4 out of 5.
The book we're discussing is called The Kremlin School of Negotiation. Intrigued? Well, here's a taste.
The Kremlin School of Negotiation is based on 5 postulates. Keep quiet and listen attentively to what your opponent says. Ask questions, impose a scale of values and depreciate your opponent. Roll out the red carpet and make the opponent an offer they can't refuse. Put the opponent in the zone of uncertainty.
Kyle Wilson, The Kremlin School of Negotiation is written by Russian business coach Igor Rizov. As we heard in that extract, the Kremlin method is about gaining trust, then upsetting the equilibrium. How does that method resonate with you in terms of the Russia you know, Kyle?
Well, first of all, I asked the most senior Australian businessman in Russia, who would prefer to remain anonymous, but who's been there for 30 years and who knows Vladimir Putin quite well, whether there was any such thing as a Kremlin school of negotiation. And he said that's complete nonsense. That is pure marketing by the author and by the publishers. Though he said you could say there's a Kremlin school of negotiation, and it would be the following. We make the rules, we set the terms of the negotiation, and you adapt. So I guess I would like to make that point that the title is misleading. You know, I mean, it seems to me the common sense rules about communication, building ease, building trust, clear objectives, good preparation, they apply everywhere. So, yeah, okay, there are Russian specifics, and they're important Russian specifics, and they become important if you're negotiating with them, but they come down to negotiating with any other country, you know, the Chinese, the Indonesians, the Indians, you've got to know them and you've got to show them that you've thought about them and that you respect them.
So, Kyle, let's go to your experience. You studied in the Soviet Union as a young student. I'd love to hear about the kind of transactional negotiations that would actually go on in everyday life. Can you give us some examples from your time there?
It's pretty hard for people who've never lived in a centrally planned economy where essentially it's a non-cash economy and where all decisions on production, marketing, distribution are taken by a bureaucrat. In other words, in the Soviet Union, the principle of supply and demand simply did not apply. Government bureaucrats decided what people needed and what they didn't need. And so in those circumstances, what you tend to get is what's really crucial is your network and the informal relationships you have. And because money didn't really have much of a role to play, I mean, as a student in the Soviet Union, my monthly stipend was 150 rubles. The wage of a fully qualified Soviet medical doctor was 120 rubles. But those 150 rubles wouldn't buy me much because money didn't open doors for you. What opened doors for you was whom you knew and what you knew.
Okay. So see that flavour of negotiation between those informal networks we're talking about. Alan, as a professional negotiator, how do you think that plays out in this book?
I'd like to endorse a lot of what Carl is saying here. One of the premises is listen carefully and ask really good quality questions. I think that's universal. the idea of trust is very fragile phenomena, because in some cultures it's smart not to trust and not to expect it. And yet in other cultures, trust is incredibly important.
And the USSR for many years was a pariah in the international community, the enemy during the Cold War. So are you then, Alan, more likely to see a boots and all negotiating style if one party is feeling backed into a corner?
Well, if I can say that there's three different ways that negotiation takes place across any culture, any environment, any industry. We're either opponents and we're tug-of-warring, and I'm putting one point of view forward and you're putting another, and we end up our best as compromise. The second one is where we might do compromise, but then we go, now that we've got a deal, what could we do together that would enrich what we've got, which means we've started to create cooperation, but it's because we cracked a deal that worked for both of us. So I don't go, do I trust you or don't I? I go, the results were there. Let me take it a step further and see how much this person wants to work with me.
Let's hear more from the book now.
As we know, whatever negotiation technique you select, it should meet the following criteria. It leads to a reasonable agreement, is effective in getting results, and improves, or at the very least doesn't worsen, relations between the parties.
Do you agree, Alan?
Yes, but it's very incomplete.
What bits are missing?
That the assumption is that the goal or the target that we're going for is actually the best one that we have. Now, if we do good ongoing negotiation and we're exploring options and possibilities and needs, we come up with innovative ideas that blows the initial goal out of the water, and we could end up with much, much more. And that's called maximisation. So you've got division, integration and maximisation. Maximisation is where we all get more.
And let's go back a step, and how would you define negotiation then, Alan?
Negotiation is every interaction that occurs between every human being, no matter what.
Okay, that's so a bit of a wider definition
a
than I had
definition.
In my head.
See, I walked into the room here today and every part of your nonverbal communication was communicating, and you were totally unconscious of what you're doing with your nonverbals. But it was welcoming, and it was engaging, it was interested, it was curious, your questions were salient. And straight away,
thank you.
The groundwork's laid for beautiful exploration of possibility.
And Kyle, did you have a different flavour on the definition of negotiation for you?
Look, I just wanted to make the point that what is reasonable for one side is not necessarily reasonable for another. I mean, definition of terms is absolutely crucial. I mean, let me give you an example. Let's take the present ongoing and bloody conflict between Russia and Ukraine. I mean, the gist of the matter here is quite clear to all of us. What are the legitimate expectations of the Russians as regards their security? And what are the legitimate expectations of the Ukrainians as regards their security? Now, if you can come to an agreement about what is legitimate, you might have the basis for a negotiation. But so how do you define reasonable? I mean, Alan, know very well there's a famous model in negotiation. It's called the pin icebergs. Two isosceles triangles sitting together, where they converge is where you have common interests. And the notion of the negotiation is to pull these triangles closer and closer together. So your interests, you identify where your interests converge or coincide, what you have in common. And on the basis of those perceptions of shared interests, you try to reach a compromise outcome. Well, that's all very well, but, you know, Alan will tell you better than me, for any negotiation, there's a precondition for any negotiation to be successful, and that is a mutual will on both sides to reach an outcome we both agree is reasonable. Well, there's a lot of negotiations don't start like that, you know. Some negotiations are simply to demonstrate that you're willing to negotiate and therefore make you look reasonable and statesmanlike, when in fact you have no desire whatsoever to reach some kind of compromise outcome because the status quo happens to suit you.
Carl, may I say that earlier I made the comment that it was true and accurate but incomplete. And a lot of what you're saying is what I was referring to. And the word I want to pick up first is the word of willingness. in any negotiation, the first thing after the preparation process, and I think preparation's got to be 80%. I managed a meeting for the United Nations 8 years ago, and it was an hour and 20-minute meeting, and I spent 6 months preparing, and I did 162 hours of interviews with every one of the 468 people.
That's what I do for business meetings as well in terms of prep.
We just don't do enough.
Yeah.
But I went in having interviewed every person in that negotiation, and people go, "You didn't." I go, "Yes, I did."
Mm.
I was the only person in the room who knew what everybody agreed to.
Because you're interested in their interests.
I showed a willingness to understand who they were and how they operated. So whether they were government or whether they were commercial, whether they were male, whether they were female, whether they were religiously oriented or not, I was working with them to gather information, but mostly to identify how did I need to think and behave so that I could complement their culture, not talk about it.
What were some of the cultural differences, Alan?
Well, if you divide the world's cultural populations into categories, philosophically, you've got indirect cultures and direct cultures. Now, your Russian language is direct, your German language is direct, your Eastern European blocs are very direct. So they make a lot of firm and clear statements. If I go to Asia, I'm not going to use definitive language, and you'll notice my voice has dropped, and your listeners can't see, but my entire body has softened. And now my eyes are indirect. My head's not facing directly at you. Mm. My eyes are softened. My eyes are now lower than yours, which is a mark of respect to you. And my gestures are soft and moving from the midline out, whereas with the German people, I'm going to have my gestures firm and strong and pointing toward them and be direct.
How important is the voice?
Oh, very.
Right.
Very.
And tell us about what the voice is signifying then for negotiation.
Well, if I do that voice quality, that sounds like I'm genuinely fascinated and interested in what it is. If I want you to think differently, I'll pause longer and I'll hold gestures. Lisa, just imagine.
So it's not
now,
one voice.
Now, if I
voice,
go, Lisa, just imagine.
Yeah.
Activating completely different parts of your brain.
So it's not one voice fits all.
No.
Mm.
My advice to everybody is whatever's in front of you, match it. So if you notice when I came into the door and you were energetic and vivacious and you were moving quite a bit, I moved with you. You were speaking quickly, I spoke quickly. Your sentence, your questions were short and precise, so my responses were...
Thought I liked you.
Yeah. Totally contrived. But it's important for me to give up being Alan and Alan's culture and going, what do I need to become to have this person feel like I'm with them?
What's interesting to me is that I feel that authenticity is important. Mm-hmm. So if you're only working on behaviours like how I'm going to change my voice, mm-hmm. aren't I going to pick up that there's something a little bit wrong here, Alan?
The first page of the book that I highlighted, the word practice was in italics and bolded, and I highlighted it.
You're
and
right.
Whatever we practice becomes authentic.
Carl Wilson, you witnessed the late Bob Hawke in action. Tell us about what you saw.
What I saw of Hawke's technique tallies with what Alan was just saying. He was pretty good at picking up signals. You know, most Australians, I think, because we're an island and we're usually not multilingual, we tend to be a bit parochial, and I think sometimes we're not too good at picking up on cultural differences and really studying other cultures and adapting, you know, without losing our own identity, because, of course, ultimately you've got to be yourself. Nonetheless, Hawke, although he spoke no foreign language, he was very good at studying his partner, and I saw him in negotiations with the then Soviet foreign minister, the Russian foreign minister, Shevardnadze. Hawke would sit back from the table. His voice would be carefully modulated, no aggressive gestures. It would never point, no emphatic gestures, you know, absolute, you know, those politicians. It was said of Bill Clinton that whenever you, if you met him, he made you feel you were the only person in the world. And Hawke had that ability to focus on his partner very closely, be sympathetic, look for a way through, show respect. So with Hawke, you had the two things. You had substance and you had style.
And you also witnessed Paul Keating in action. How different was his style?
Well, Keating was the most effective negotiator of those I saw dealing with the Chinese, though the other one who was very effective was Tim Fischer, former Deputy Prime Minister, but known for his sincerity. But Keating was remarkable because, well, he had Hawke's ability to listen, Hawke's ability to focus, Hawke's ability to put the Chinese at their ease by his body language. Alan was referring to that. But also he had marvellous little tricks. And one of them I saw in action a couple of times is he would use props. So if sitting at a formal banqueting table, he would pick up the knife or the fork. On one occasion, he was trying to explain to the Chinese the importance of trust and not being hyper-suspicious. And he was saying that the former Chinese Prime Minister Li Peng was hyper-suspicious, and he lifted up the plate and looked under it, then he lifted up the napkin and looked under that, and then he looked under the table. And the Chinese were absolutely fascinated. And they knew what he was saying. What he was saying was respectful. By that stage, by the way, Li Peng had already retired. But Keating's message was, look, you can take suspicion too far.
Yep.
We need to find a modicum of being at ease with each other, if not trust, you know. But these little gestures and, you know, this stage business, it was hugely effective with the Chinese.
Let's hear more from the Kremlin School of Negotiation.
If you don't want a fight to heat up, don't get personal. Instead, set out the facts and try to make fewer value judgments. Separating the individual from the issue at stake is key.
Ooh, this is an interesting area. Alan Parker, what do you think about this separation?
If I may honour the late Roger Fisher, Lisa's just showed me the book. She has the book I'm referring to on her
desk. It's well loved, this book by Roger Fisher.
It's a must read book.
The book is called Getting to Yes.
And in that, they were the first people to talk about cooperation as a mode that they were recommending, not competition. First time ever. And they said, we have to separate the problem. Now, what Keating was doing was locating the problem somewhere else so that it wasn't between him and the person that they were talking to. So he was depersonalizing and putting the problem over there so that the relationship could exist between them and the problem didn't cause tension.
But I think what it recognises, so the Roger Fisher approach, getting to yes, is that you are negotiating with a human being.
Yes.
And those deeper human needs tend to trump because we get into the limbic system, we get into this reactive system if you're not aware of it.
Exactly. The moment that the limbic system, the emotional part of the brain, the reptilian brain, runs the show, you're in trouble. And it is actually stated in the book.
Carl Wilson, have you witnessed any disastrous negotiations?
I'm just thinking of a famous case where the Australian government, on behalf of Carlton United Breweries, put a lot of effort into supporting a negotiation. Carlton United was seeking a license to establish a brewery in Tianjin in China, and all went very well for a long time, and they were getting towards agreement, signature of agreement, and they invited a Chinese delegation to Melbourne, and all went well, Chinese restaurants, they observed most of the cultural proprieties, and then came the very end where it was an exchange of gifts. And the members of the Chinese delegation were given by Carlton United Breweries a Carlton United Breweries baseball cap, which was green. Now, there's an expression in Chinese, lu maozi, to wear a green hat.
Oh.
It means, what it means is your partner is cheating on you.
Oh.
Now, of course, the Chinese understood this was just the barbarian's ignorance. But as you can imagine, it was most unfortunate.
Is it the long game that we should be working towards when it comes to negotiation? Because maybe it's not a failure to walk away if you preserved your position and the relationship for a later date.
I mean, I think that's crucial. Alan would know full well that, you know, one of the truisms about negotiation is that you know, negotiations are really productive unless both sides have a mutual interest in a future relationship, an ongoing relationship. So, you know, it's a little bit like the meeting that you go to, and the objective of you, your objective in the meeting is that the person you meet will be impressed by you and will want to see you again. It seems to me, you know, there's a parallel here. So if you're going into a negotiation thinking in the longer term, and autocracies tend to do that. Mr. Putin has been in power for 20 years, but we suffer from this disadvantage of short-termism. So it seems to me that, you know, a wise negotiator will be thinking, okay, we have this specific task to achieve, let us say, with the Indonesians or the Chinese. At the end of the day, we want to come away with at least a handshake between four walls, preferably a signed piece of paper. But no, we will be dealing with Indonesia, our largest neighbour, for decades to come. So it's important to bear that in mind.
Okay, let's hear a final extract from the Kremlin School of Negotiation.
Remember, negotiations cannot be won or lost. It's only possible to determine exactly where you are and what your next steps need to be.
Alan, do you agree with that?
It's very accurate and very incomplete. I'm a behavioural scientist for the listeners in micro behaviour. So my entire life's research has been what happens in 3 seconds. So it's about how do I manage now? And then the next now, and 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 the next now. And I break everything into 3 second bits. And I go, Lisa's now nodding her head at me and giving me acknowledgement. So I'm going to affirm that again. And now I've got more acknowledgement.
Did you see that wink?
The minute you get the nod and the wink,
yeah.
I then go, next subject.
So I've noticed a couple of times you've mentioned that the book is incomplete. So In summary, Alan,
yep.
In your professional experience as a negotiator, What do you think of this book, The Kremlin School of Negotiation?
The Kremlin book, I agree with the first comment about the title. It's just marketing. The book itself is a relatively realistic perspective on competitive, oppositional and enemy-oriented management in a relationship context. It mentions occasionally the need to cooperate and work together, but it doesn't give you any of those tools. And it doesn't go anywhere near maximisation. So it doesn't go, how do we all work together to get more than we all want?
And Carl, you're not a fan of the book. What would your top negotiation books be?
Look, I don't want to dissuade people from buying and reading this book. Igor Rizov is a Russian. For centuries, Russia has had a kind of highly ambivalent relationship with the countries around it. And for much of its history, it has perceived itself as being in a hostile relationship with countries around it. They are naturally combative. It's worth reading. What it's worth reading for are the historical anecdotes, which are absolutely fascinating. So I would say read the historical anecdotes. They are really fascinating. My best book, I suppose my favourite book, is called Riding the Waves of Culture. It's by two authors, a Dutchman, an Englishman, Trompenaars and Hampden Turner, Riding the Waves of Culture.
Great. Well, now I've got lots of reading. Thank you both. Kyle Wilson, former diplomat, Russian expert, visiting fellow at the Centre for European Studies at ANU, and Alan Parker, consultant, negotiator and author of a number of books, including The Negotiator's Toolkit. Privyet to both. And a very special thanks to Victoria Stankiva. Victoria is a former journalist and Russian expat now living in Sydney who runs an annual networking event for the Russian-speaking business community. And Victoria very kindly did those book readings for us. I'm Lisa Leong, and this episode of This Working Life was produced by Kathy Pryor, and the sound engineer was Selwyn Cousins. To listen to our other book clubs, check out our podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. And if you do like what you hear, please do rate and review. It all counts. Until next week, keep working. Can I just say, you both have seen a lot, and we should do a secret episode with all of your stories.
That could be frightening, I suspect.
Very frightening indeed.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.